Tonight on Arena, Vincent Dubois, the organist in Paris' Notre Dame Cathedral, and new albums from Joy Crooks, Coldplay and Phineas up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. We start this evening with The Map, a short title for a monumental new textile by artists Alice Marr and Rachel Fallon. It's about to go on display at Rua Red Gallery in Tala in Dublin. The second exhibition in the Magdalene series in Rua Red, a series curated by gallery director Melissa Boyle, in which five artists are invited to create work in response to the figure of Mary Magdalene. Marr and Fallon have created a world that is sewn, painted, crocheted, and it's playful and deadly serious all at the same time. Continents, winds, currents, constellations, and lots of metaphorical statements being made as well, I'm sure. The Map is rich in detail, in text and in imagery. It is 6.5 metres wide, 4.5 metres high. For those of you still working in old money, that is 21 feet by almost 15 feet. Most of all, it's a reimagining of the life and legacy of Mary Magdalene and a tribute to the invisible labour of women everywhere. Delighted to have Alice Marr and Rachel Fallon in studio with me right now. And so that people know what we're talking about, Alice and Rachel, we're going to tweet up an image of the two of you, in fact, standing. It's of the map, really, but we have the two of you standing in front of it, which will give people a sense of scale here. So at RTE Arena, if you want to look at that image, we'll be talking about specific elements within the image as well. But purely in terms of scale, this is a very big work, Alice.
Yes, it's a very big work and it took a very long time to make. So Rachel and I have been working on this for over 2.5 years now. The time is part of the work. Obviously, you know, the element of time is sewn into the work as well. But then, of course, kind of COVID happened as we'd started our work. So, you know, we had these kind of lockdown one, two, three. So it kept extending, and the work kept getting bigger and bigger, you know. So that was all part of it as well. So
And the nature of it, is it actually one single piece that you had to do as one big item sitting on the floor in one or other gallery somewhere? Or could you do little sections then that you could bring and put almost like a quilt making exercise? Could you bring pieces in and sew them on or whatever, Rachel?
A certain extent. I mean, it was conceived as a sculptural piece, so it is actually, you know, crafted as a sculpture, but then there's elements of it that were piecework. So each of us took pieces, because Alice is in Mayo and I'm in Bray. My studio is in Rua Red, but it meant that we were both, you know, during lockdown, over phones and over Zooms, showing one another pieces that we'd made, sending them back and forth by post. So it was a geographical exercise as well, which is quite pertinent to it being a map. And then it was every time we came together, we would add bits, more pieces together and stitch them together. But yes, I mean, it has that social element that quilting brings to it, which is also part of that work that women do that, you know, is very... collaborative.
Yeah, I suppose just to get a sense of what we're actually looking at in it's in its entirety, Alice. If we can do that, I'm going to say midnight blue sky. Is that acceptable to describe it in that color? And then essentially, we're looking at, it's a map of the world or a world.
Map. Yeah. I mean, interestingly, someone said to us earlier, but there's no north, south, east and west. Like, where's the direction? And there isn't any direction. So you can enter that map anywhere you like. And that blue that you're talking about, you know, that kind of surrounds it, that's the constellations, you know, that you see the map of the night sky, as it were. So we take down the constellations in the night sky, like the Great Bear or, you know, Orion. Belt, and we re-mythologize imagery to that sky that are related to the Magdalene. You know, for instance, the wrens, you know, like the wrens of the Cura, or the Whore of Babylon, or, you know, we have many different, the little laundress, you know, many different things that we have reconstituted the constellations, shall you say, to fit in with our map.
Yes, so you've, as Alice put it there, you've re-mythologized the stories around the constellations of the sky. And have you attached all of them then, Rachel, to some kind of female figure or female hero that you want to highlight in some way?
Well, I mean, the thematic that we were given at the beginning was Mary Magdalene. And when we, you know, each of the artists within the group has taken a different route to this. So Amanda Coogan took the Wrens, and Alice and myself were really looking at that idea of how Mary Magdalene is a composite figure, how she is very elusive. There's lots and lots of books written about it, but she's very hard to pin down. And we wanted to develop her as a sort of every woman, yeah, in a way, and also as a female experience, rather than pinning it down to one particular archetype or one particular narrative.
So I guess if I were to ask either of you, what does Mary Magdalene mean to you? You wouldn't want to pin it down into any one thing. That's the whole point here, Alice.
Well, she kind of represents the way that female, say, historical and mythological figures have been kind of co-opted into belief systems, you know, by, for instance, particular church beliefs, you know, who then use those archetypes to suppress and control women in what they do, in the map of their lives, in their social life, in their sexual life, in their private life, you know.
Yeah.
So we're very interested. And Mary Magdalene is one of these kind of mythological figures because she is a composite, you know, as Rachel said, because she's only mentioned a couple of times, you know, in the Bible. But in something like 591, you know, Pope Gregory decided that he would amalgamate Mary of Bethany, the woman who washed the feet of Jesus, you know, Mary of the desert, and Mary Magdalene all into one. So he made, you know, this kind of figure a penitent sinner. And that's the kind of figure, you know, that has gone out there as representative of one side of female. There's the penitent sinner, the sexual sinner, and then there's the virgin, like the virgin and the whore, you know.
The whore and the Madonna, it's those polar opposites. But even in contemporary culture, in the kind of attitudes that might be around Mary Magdalene, they differ from country to country. I mean, there's a very different attitude. In this country, the word Mary Magdalene always has that. And I don't like the term fallen woman, but it's the only term I can use to kind of describe the attitude that, or the sort of ideas that are attached to Mary Magdalene. In France, she's a totally different person.
In France, she's venerated. You know, you have the shrine of Mary Magdalene, and in, you know, the various different bishops in various areas created mythologies around her, of her landing in Marseille and coming here and working with various different people. So there's her hand, which has a whole shrine attached to it. Her head and her cave, you know, is another part of a pilgrimage. So it's had huge capitalistic aspects to it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is important to remember that those other aspects of Mary Magdalene are there. It's just that in this country, and a lot of that relates to, I mean, the choice of Magdalene for the laundries in and of itself was quite a move when you think about it. I'm looking at one of the little books that came with the exhibition, which is one of the constellations is called The Little Laundress. And an obvious reference there, I'm presuming, Alice Marr, to the Magdalene laundries. Yes. But even more important than that, on the map of this world that we're looking at, and it is up there on the Arena Twitter page at RTE Arena if you want to look at it, kind of in not quite in the centre, it's just a little bit off to the right of centre as you look at it, is a place called The System. You might describe what that island on this map shows to us, Alice.
The System, it's like a two-tier island. There's above and below. And on the upper part, what you see are the plans of all the Magdalene laundries in Ireland. And underneath that, like in the cellar, you see the workers on their knees cleaning and scrubbing. And that system is held up, as you can see, by the Caryatides, these female Virgin Mary figures who hold up that world and contribute, you know what I mean, to that kind of hiding of, you know, what's happening in the cellar.
As when you can look right in at the detail, which obviously if people are either looking at the booklet that I have in front of me, or if they're out in Rue aux Reds looking at the actual exhibit itself, the architecture of containment. How much of a starting point was that element? I know the constellations were very important initially, Rachel, but when did it move off that into the specific elements of different islands?
Well, I mean, when we started to imagine what this could be, we began developing a language with one another, and that was really by sending one another drawings every day over quite a long period of time.
Yeah.
and we noticed that certain aspects came up, and this was how we kind of began to group them. And at the top of the map, we have, you know, Lilith's experience, the Garden of Eve, and those very first kind of female entities who arrive on the scene. And as we get nearer to the bottom, we become more, it comes more into present day and what we know, you know, now. So there's a piece at the bottom of the map that deals with things around the Ryan and the McAleese report. Or there's, you know, the wonderful Imaginal Forest, which is about, you know, possibilities and
of change.
Of change, yeah. You know, yeah. Things that could happen.
Yeah. There's a lot of mending and, you know, repairing and stuff in certain islands.
Yeah, there are islands of possibility here, and I suppose, things that might come to pass. An important part of the exhibition, and I want to play a clip that gives a sense, is a sound installation that Sinead Gleeson has put together. Just explain what the idea, because it's kind of like, I don't know whether you would call it an aural accompaniment to what you're looking at on the map. Explain what the idea behind Sinead's role was, Alice.
Well, we both admired Sinead Gleeson's work, you know, an awful lot. And we knew straight away when we were asked, each artist from the Magdalene series got the opportunity to invite a writer to write a text to accompany their work. So we invited Sinead Gleeson to do that. And when she came to speak to us and look, you know, at the map, she immediately started work on this kind of traveller, this figure who moves within the map. She saw it as a journey straight away, like a type of saga. Or, you know,
I was saying it's like there's a sense of Chaucer's Tales.
Chaucer's Tales or the Odyssey.
And it's actually, Progress, that type of thing.
And she actually used 24 stanzas, you know, as there are in the Odyssey as well. So, you know, she wrote this beautiful kind of incantatory kind of text. Mm. And so I don't know if it was it you, Rachel, who said to her that it would it be a sound piece? Or I forget exactly how that came up, because she has a beautiful voice herself. Yeah. And then her partner, Stephen Shannon, is a composer, you know, and sound technician.
So I think this is actually the opening of the text, as it were. But just as I'm sure you can go to any part of the island first, you can probably join the sound installation at any point, and it will still make sense. Let's have a listen.
You do not need to know my name, but I am Mary, Amina, Penelope, Bridget, Persephone, Frida, Maeve, Makeda, Sojourner, Groenewail, Cassiopeia, Nan. I am Hecate, Rosa, Lakshmi, Afra, the X-case girl, the women given letters, not names, Sappho, Marcia, Mora, Edna, Green Tara, Black Madonna. I am the first girl child they put in the septic tank. Come to the loud feral Herland, She-land, they-land, Equinopolis, Cisopolis, Transopolis, a republic of personhood. I am the map. We are the map.
And that's the sound of Sinead Gleeson and Stephen Shannon's installation, We Are the Map, which is part of the MAP exhibition that Alice Marr and Rachel Fallon are talking to me about this evening. Just before we finish up, and again, I'll put people to look at the Twitter page at RT Arena if they're looking at this picture of the map itself, the big textile work. To the left of centre is a little place. Well, it's not a little place. It's a pink place called Ilon Ulk, which translates as Slag Island, where you will find the fields of Salome, Delilah Drive, Jezebel Heights and Medea Drive. Tell me a little bit about what sort of a place is Ilon Ulk, Rachel?
Well, I would consider it to be a great fun place. And it's the sort of place where all the bad women and the women who, you know, were not allowed to be part of society actually would go to have a really good time among themselves. But it also shows how we use these words against women and how we constrain women with the words, you know. So it looks very nice and it looks very, you know, sweet. And yet these are words that are used, you know, with a very sharp meaning.
Yeah.
There's an area there like called the Furies, you know, where each street is called after the kind of language that's assigned to women, you know, like squeaking, squawking, you know. And then there's Strumpet City, where every street is called Mary. And then there's Coventown, where all the witches live.
Yeah. And where the Hound and Harlot Inn.
The Hound and Harlot Inn, where we have a pint.
Yeah, and there's also a square here that has a Shrew side and a Slut side. And yes. There's a Slut Walk North up there as well.
Yeah, and south.
So lots of detail to be seen on the map. And that's why people must go and see it. You mentioned there the five artists. We spoke with Amanda Coogan about the Wrens thing that she had done. Alice Marr and Rachel Fallon with me this evening. The other two artists involved in the Magdalene series with Rua Red are Jesse Jones and Grace Dias. But the map by Alice Marr and Rachel Fallon, and We Are the Map, the sound installation by Sinead Gleeson and Stephen Shannon, all at Rua Red Gallery in Tallaght from the 18th of October through until the 29th of January. So you've lots of time to get to see it, but don't leave it too long. Suddenly it'll be gone. So you get out there at some point along the way and have a look for yourself in at the detail of it all. ruared.ie for full detail. On the 15th of April 2019, the world heard the awful news that a fire was blazing through the beautiful Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris. By the time the fire was extinguished, the building's spire had collapsed and most of its roof had been destroyed. As the world watched in horror, my next guest had a very personal connection with the cathedral. He is Vincent Dubois, who holds the prestigious position of titulaire of Notre Dame Cathedral. Vincent is in Dublin to perform for Pipeworks, the Dublin International Organ and Choral Festival, and he will present a programme of music including work by Dupré and his student Jean de Messieu. I'm delighted that Vincent joins me in studio this evening. Can I go back to that horrendous night, April 15th, 2019? How did you hear about the fire, Vincent?
Well, I was on the highway driving my car back home, and my friend Johan Vexot, which is one of the two choir organists in Notre Dame, he just called me. He was playing during the mass, and just the alarm in the cathedral rang at that time, and he had to evacuate. And he just called me. He was just he had such a voice, incredibly. I have never heard him like that, and told me the cathedral burnt. The cathedral is burning. The cathedral is burning, and I will always remember that phone call. And I told him, "What are you saying? Are you crazy or what? What's that?" And he told me, "Turn on your TV, and you will see what I'm speaking about." And when I went back home, then I could see and notice this incredible fire and stay stuck in front of my TV the whole night.
I can imagine. And I mean, for any of us, even for people in this country who certainly would not have the type of attachment to the cathedral and particularly to the organs in the cathedral that you would have, I mean, watching it was so upsetting and so difficult to actually fathom what was going on. There was this sense of, you know, such an emblem of civilization crumbling in front of us. When did you get to visit the cathedral subsequent to that? At what point could you actually go in and sort of survey the damage that was done to the organs and what you might have to think about in that respect?
I couldn't visit the cathedral since the fire. I would have loved to, but the problem was about this ash in the cathedral. And if you wanted to visit, the protocol was so complicated to go through. So we got many, many photos, I would say almost every day after the fire, but then it was a little more calm. but what was just incredible was this impression when you see this cathedral burning. It's for me like seeing a member of my family burning in front of me, and you are totally armless to do anything. You cannot help. This impression is terrible. You know,
and you're sitting at home watching this.
I was sitting at home watching that and saying, wow, it's like La Joconde at the Louvre Museum will be burnt if the organ burned.
Yeah. And what? How many organs were or are in the cathedral, and what kind of damage was done, or what were you most worried about?
So there is the great organ and the choir organ, so two organs. There is a positive as well, but it's in the sacristy. So, but those two organs, one of both, the choir organ has a lot of damage. The pipes could be saved, but not all, because it took many, many water.
Yeah, just to...
Because it was just next to this hole in the nave, and then the firemen had to throw a lot of water at that place, so lots of dripping water.
Yeah, so obviously that damage is...
But the great organ was okay, and totally safe.
Well, that was the upside, I guess.
Yeah.
If there can't have been many upsides, but anything that survived and wasn't badly damaged, that must have been a good thing. And that is it. The great organ that goes right back to the 12th century, parts of it.
The organ was built in the 15th century. Actually, there was an organ before that, but it was not at the same place as it is now. So the organ you mentioned was in the choir, near by the choir, and then it was destroyed.
Yeah.
But then the new organ, which is the actual position of the organ, the great organ, was built in 1403.
What I said that you were a titulaire of Notre Dame Cathedral. What exactly is that? What's involved in that job?
Yeah, when you are titulaire organist in organ in general in France, that means you are in charge of playing, accompany the masses, and you have also to be the man who is having the contact with the organ builder in case there are some rebuildings to do. So in Notre Dame, that means we are three titulaires of this organ, and we share all weekends in 1 year. That means the great organ just plays on the weekends and big event if there are some events in the week. And so we have about 17 18 weekends each of us to accompany in a year.
Yeah. And some weekends then that you can come to Ireland and be part of the Pipeworks Festival.
Clearly, exactly.
There's somebody else busy this weekend back in Paris. It ain't Vincent Dubois. Yeah. Let us get a sense of some of the music that you'll be playing as part of your recital, Vincent, which will be at St. Michael's Church in Dunleary on Sunday. This is a piece by Dupré. Maybe tell me a little bit about Dupré as an organist and a composer for organ, and what the piece is we're going to listen to part of.
Well, I will play this symphonic poem named Evocation, the finale of this poem in three movements, so the finale. And Dupré was one of the most renowned organists in the world in 20th century, and mostly in France. He has created these big lines of great organists that we still know today. Mm.
So this is the finale, and you know that there's a colloquial saying in English, pull out all the stops, which refers to the organ.
That's it.
I would guess for this finale, all of the stops on the organ are open and all of the pipes are making sound. Let's have a listen to a little bit of the opening of the finale. A little section there from the Evocation for Organ of Marcel Dupré, the finale played by Vincent Dubois, who's with me in studio this evening ahead of his appearance at the St. Michael's Church in Dunleary as part of the Pipeworks Festival. And I was asking as we were playing there, that's in Rotterdam that recording was made.
Yes, in a big church and with a huge organ.
Yeah. There. Well, that's obviously what you, for a work like that, you mean you must have some, you haven't seen, I was asking as we were listening, you haven't seen the organ in St. Michael's in Dunleary yet, but you must have some sense of the size of the organ and the number of stops that are there and what's possible. So you know that this work can be performed on that organ.
Well, every organ is different, of course, but we receive normally before a concert the composition of the instrument. And if it allows to play lots of repertoire, then it's better to hear for the people the most various aesthetic and styles from many composers, because organ is not that well known as violin, piano, chamber orchestra, etc. So for people who doesn't know anything about organ, it's always good that they could hear many different things. So here in this organ, in St. Michael's, it's possible to play many things from 18th century until now. So
yeah. And you'll be playing some Bach as well on the night?
Yes, one prelude and fugue from Bach. So this famous, as the American, they call the Sainte-Anne prelude and fugue. So it's a prelude and triple fugue, actually, from the what Bach has called his grande messe, the great mass for organ. So the prelude is the opening and the fugue is the conclusion.
Yeah, I presume as an organist, you do believe that you have literally got an orchestra at your hands and feet, because both are involved in the playing of the organ. Was it the automatic choice of instrument for you? Did you go via piano to it, or were you immediately saying, no, I want to be an organist?
Well, I was very attracted by the organ when I was very young, about 6-7 years old, and I said to my mother, I want to do that. And she told me, okay, but first you have to do the piano. Okay, so I started first the piano, and by age 11-12, I started the organ, but in parallel with the piano. Right. And I loved the piano very, very much, so I did both at a high level, as maximum as I could do, because at a certain point you have to choose, really.
Yeah, yeah. The time comes when you have to. And if you,
but I choose when I discover the organ of Notre Dame. First one, I played it at 16.
16.
Yeah. And then I said, that's it.
Yeah, man. And it was love at first play.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was shocked. Vincent, merci. Thanks so much for being with us this evening. That's Vincent Dubois. And Vincent will be performing at St. Michael's Church in Dunleary as part of the Pipeworks Festival. And you can find that this Sunday he's playing there. And you can find out full details on the website pipeworks.ie. And so to album reviews on this Friday evening. First up will be Coldplay, a band who always seem to divide opinion, even though they've crafted some of the most memorable pop songs of the century so far. Recent collaboration with Korean band BTS will certainly help to spread the Coldplay gospel to a new generation. Today, their ninth studio album arrives. It's called Music of the Spheres. Next up, a Londoner of Irish and Bangladeshi heritage, Joy Crooks, busy making classy under-the-radar jazz-infused pop for some years now. She signed to Sony Music last year. Her much-anticipated debut album Skin is also released today. And finally, a key player behind the success of one of the great pop sensations of recent time, she being Billie Eilish, has been her brother, Phineas, or to give him his full name, Phineas Baird O'Connell. At the age of just 24, he has already 8 Grammy Awards under his belt. Today, we welcome Optimist. Again, highly anticipated, his solo debut. Zara Hederman and John Mayer have been listening to all three. Let's start with Coldplay. Music of the Spheres, as I say, is the title of the album. Features Korean megastars, which is a kind of an understatement in the case of BTS even. This track is called My Universe. There's a paradise they couldn't capture, that bright infinity inside your eyes. 매일 밤 내게 날아가 꿈이란 것도 믿은 채 나 웃으며 너를 만나. Never ending forever baby. Universe, the title of that track from Coldplay and their new album Music of the Spheres. As I said, Zara Hederman and John Mayer are two reviewers on this evening. What is it about Coldplay, Zara? You know, they can obviously play any, catchy tunes. Mm. We'd nearly be singing that even just after whatever, a minute and a half of listening to it. It really, they're earworms. They know how to do that. but they are the least cool band of all time.
Yeah, and they kind of always have been. And it's a shame because actually at the start, I do think when you revisit their albums like Parachutes and A Rush of Blood to the Head, they are actually very good albums. But the further you go into their discography and the more quotes you read from Chris Martin, their frontman, and it must be said that he does have an ear for songwriting. He knows how to write a hook. He knows how to like get into your ear. But the more you read from him of just wanting to be the biggest band, he basically, I think, just wants to be kind of Bono Jr. in just building a stadium persona. He doesn't really care about the music anymore, I don't think. And I think that that's very evident on this album.
Oh, that's very hard. Are you saying, and would you agree, John, that getting BTS on board is purely a commercial move rather than an artistic decision?
It is 100% a commercial move.
BTS
are the biggest pop act on the planet by a considerable distance. Not just that, they also have Selena Gomez here as well. Now, Selena Gomez is the fifth most popular person on Instagram. So it's almost like Chris Martin said to producer...
But is she ahead of me, yeah?
Just about. But it's almost like Chris Martin said to Max Martin, the uber Swedish mega producer and songwriter. He said, look, let's get some of the biggest and most famous people on earth on this album, because our last album, Everyday Life, didn't do particularly well, and we really want to go back and do enormous gigs again, of which Croke Park will almost certainly be one of them next year.
You mentioned Selena Gomez. Let's have a little listen. This is very sad. I'm too emotional to play any more now of Selena Gomez and Chris Martin there. It hurts like so. Is that it hurts like so to let somebody go. Lyricist of some kind or other, John Marr, is Chris Martin. Although he's never claimed to be anything but a fairly regular.
Do you know, I think if you go back to songs like The Scientist, you know, he actually was a decent lyricist and he could evoke real empathy. I just can't get the Chris Martin who cameoed in Extras and Curb Your Enthusiasm out of my head listening to this album. It's almost like this is a jape for him, that he's not taking this seriously.
But I think, Zara, you wouldn't say he's not taking it seriously. You say he's seriously taking big dollar signs all over his eyes. Not just him, it must be the management and the other members of the band as well.
Absolutely, it takes a village. Yeah, completely.
to make an album.
But as John was saying there, it does kind of, there is something about this that does feel like in a few years' time, he'll turn around and be like, this was a joke. Because there is a theme to this album, and the theme is that it is set on a fictional planetary system called the Spheres, with 9 planets, 3 natural satellites, a star, and a nearby nebula.
Thank you for that.
No worries.
Because it cues up perfectly what I want both of you to listen to very carefully. This is how the Coldplay album opens. That's enough. I just wanted to play that because when that opening 53 seconds of track one, I can't tell you what it's called because there's about 3 or 4 tracks on the album which have nothing more than little emojis. They're not even emojis, they're like little symbols. And this one kind of looks like Saturn. It could be Saturn.
The issue with Coldplay is that there aren't enough words in the English language to capture what it is they're trying to say.
And for 53 seconds, or at least for about 20 of the 53 seconds, I thought, Coldplay are going to do something new on this album.
Well,
Did you not have a moment of optimism?
It sounded Eno-esque. I mean, I think John Hopkins has a significant role to play here. But like, Coldplay have always been interested in stars. I mean, Yellow, look at the stars. Look how they shine for you. A sky full of stars.
I put it to you, Mr. Mark. You're avoiding my question, so I will go to Ms. Ederman on it. Did you not have a split, even if it was only a short moment at the beginning of the album, when you thought, this Coldplay are going to actually do something different now here?
No, not at all.
I was alone in my optimism.
Yeah, no, I didn't at all, because I kind of know what I get with Coldplay now. I know that it's not going to be inventive. I know that it's just going to be very homogenous and very what was trendy 3 years ago to try and get them some kind of prowess.
No moments at all on the album that you would say, oh yeah, there's something in that.
The closing track, Coloratura, it had some like glimpses, like very fleeting moments of some nice instrumentation to it. There's some kind of nice layered synthesized vocals on Infinity Sign, which is otherwise a terrible song.
So but no, there's stars? Not much. How many stars is it getting, or emojis of some
just
kind?
The one star, liking the theme for the album.
Liking the theme, one star, John.
I also like Coloratura. I think a lot of John Hopkins on that track, and it unfurls over 10 minutes and it's good. Higher Power, just before I get to stars, Higher Power feels like the Christian rock band that Coldplay have always wanted to be. For me, it's a much more generous 2 stars.
Oh, God, I'm glad you weren't being parsimonious. 1 and 2, respectively, then, for Music of the Spheres from Coldplay. Let's move on to Joy Crooks, raised in London by a father from Dublin, so she's Irish as far as we're concerned. Her mother's Bangladeshi. She has been releasing music since 2017. Her debut album, Skin, is out today. Let's have a listen to a track called 19th Floor.
Headed back to where I started. Past the fireflies, a grizzly burning bright. Lost the tower where my floor,
the title of that track from Joy Crooks and her debut album Skin. This is an entirely different prospect, I'm guessing, Zara Hederman. Joy Crooks, very young, start of her career, but look at where she's at already.
Yeah, phenomenal. And even when you just hear her vocals there, there's just so much experience in her voice. And what I loved, especially with that song in particular, it really brought me to say, like, Massive Attack's Blue Lines. And on this album, she does really well. It's her debut, and she does so well to, like, bring a really diverse range of, like, R&B to some really cool thumping 60s styles, and then some also like really pretty piano melodies. And through it, her lyricism is very strong. She's very candid about, you know, her heritage, about her experiences as a woman in her early 20s. She touches on sexual assault. She touches on politics as well in Britain. So I think that this is a very important and a very interesting listen from start to finish.
And it's hard to listen to any track really, John, without hearing some kind of reference to Amy Winehouse. It's a similar voice. It's not as raw maybe as Amy Winehouse's voice, but there's something in there that certainly reminds me of Amy
there
Winehouse.
There is, absolutely. There is that extraordinary quality to her vocal where you hang on to every single word. As Zara says, the production is very special. A guy called Blue May is responsible for it. It's that nocturnal dubstep sort of ambient electronica that reminds me of a lot of the stuff from the 90s, particularly people like Sharon Nelson's vocal on top of it. And it's a really interesting album. I mean, she was the recipient of the Brit Rising Star Award a few years ago. And often people that get, acclaimed when they're still in their teen years can struggle with a debut album to rise to expectations. I mean, there's no struggle here.
No, and I mean, let's have a listen to another track. We'll talk a little bit more about her again after this. This is a track called Feet Don't Fail Me Now.
But I don't like when my better side takes hold of me. I didn't want you to know. Man, I guess I was scared. Feet don't fail me now. I got to stand my ground. And know I'm down for trying. I am better in denial. So I don't make
Feel Me Now, another of the tracks on Joy Crooks' debut album, an album called Skin. And very upbeat feel to that, and upbeat feel to some of the songs that are on there, very easy to listen to. But when you look into what she's actually saying and singing, it's very interesting. You have the lyrics there, Zara, of the opening track, which is I Don't Mind. Maybe just give us a little flavour of
it. Yeah, of course. So she opens, the very opening lines to the album are, "You wanted my body and not my mind." And then she goes on to talk about, you know, someone putting their hand to her face and realising that she's just a face. And later on in the album as well, there's a line that I couldn't stop thinking about and going back to. And it's on that song, Unlearn You, which is details her experience of sexual assault. And like you're saying, very upbeat melodies. That one has a very sweet pop melody to it, and she has a line where she says, "I didn't ever wear a dress in case you thought I was asking for it." And I think that that is such a striking lyric, especially in the last couple of years, how we hear about sexual violence against women.
And again, there's a track further down called Power, where she really talks about, you know, taking the power for yourself and don't let the power lie with somebody else.
And there's an intro, that song we just heard as well, the really powerful line for me, which is, "Put my name on petitions, but I won't change my mind. I'm keeping up appearances, the dark side of my privilege." I mean, the sense of virtue signalling. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot going on. Absolutely.
Yeah. Stars from you on this one, John.
A very solid four.
A solid four.
Yeah,
a
solid four for me as well.
Yeah, it's quite the album. I want to go back to it a few times, have a proper listen. Joy Crooks and Skin, the title of that one. Let's move on then to Phineas Baird O'Connell, professionally known as Phineas, better known as the brother, a producer of Billie Eilish. Poor guy, he's never ever going to be anything other than the brother of Billie Eilish, is he? Well, not a bad thing to be, I'm sure. He's a producer as well. It's going to always be difficult for him to break out and do a solo album, Zara.
Yeah, of course. And I was actually quite surprised that this was only the first album that we were getting from him, especially given his accolades and his Producer of the Year Grammy. And it is difficult, especially listening to this. And I felt really bad listening to this a lot of the time, thinking of the through line between his work with Billie Eilish and on this album. And I don't necessarily think that what he brings to this album is kind of like spillover and he's recycling ideas. I just think that it's a very good reflection of his production flares that he's developing so young.
And let's have a listen to a bit of a track called The 90s.
When I was not a problem yet, all the time I should have been so happy. I was here wasting it on worrying, just made it disappear. Now my head feels so heavy, I'm left holding up the levee. Feels so foreign, I'm already home. I think about the 90s.
I think about the 90s, the line that he's singing there. He's
24, so he doesn't remember the 90s.
In 1997.
I absolutely remember the 90s. I wouldn't be quite as nostalgic as he would be. But
the bits you forget are for different reasons.
But as Zara says, like, we listen to that track and this guy knows his way around a studio. I mean, there's so much smarts there. And he's... for me, it's a bit of a calling card to other artists to say, look, if you want your music to sound amazing, get me on board.
Yeah, because as I listened to that song, I thought, somehow I just couldn't take him seriously singing about the 90s. Then I thought, well, maybe be generous. Maybe he's thinking, maybe it's a kind of a song for his parents or something, you know, that he's thinking of them and their nostalgia for the 90s.
What it is just himself and his sister have been, the fame thing has got to them. And in the, you know, particularly social media that constant scrutiny. And there's a sense there about longing for a pre-digital age.
Yeah. You mentioned the word emo in connection with this album, and it's a bit there. In that song in the 90s, there are other ones. Love is Pain is another song that gives a sense of explain emo and tell us why you think, well, it is emo, isn't it, in some ways?
Yeah, there was just one or two instances where his lyrical content, it is that very, and not to be condescending, but it is just very like, very early in your 20s, you're breaking up with someone, the opening track is about buying concert tickets for someone that you fancy a year in advance, and then there's a lot of maudlin things about death and thinking about his parents dying, which are concerns that I think a lot of people would have when they're growing up. But I did just think that his lyrical content on this album isn't what is going to draw me back into it. It's the soundscapes for sure.
Yeah, although, you know, there's another track called Only a Lifetime. Don't waste the time you have have waiting for time to pass, which is a very wise piece of advice.
Absolutely.
But it is a bit difficult. If it was from coming from somebody else's...
Yeah, I wanted him
to be better than this.
I did too. And the transition from backroom person to front person is difficult. And Bruno Mars managed it. But I was disappointed by this. It just didn't grab me enough. I mean, you kind of feel these songs would work well with somebody else. Reminded me a bit of Jack Antonoff from the band Fun. And he, you know, had momentary fame a while back, but he's a really good backroom person. And unfortunately, that's what I feel about Optimist. I'm not wildly optimistic that he's going to be a major star.
Yeah, well, he has 8 Grammys to his name as a backroom person. So he's doing okay, as
for
me.
Sure.
What are your feelings overall, Zara? Were you in the disappointed mode here as well?
I was kind of surprised by it. But at the same time, what I did appreciate from this album is just how sometimes when you hold things back with your productions, how you can actually give quite a lot. And I don't think he's reinventing the wheel, but I do think that there is a lot of invention here in the kind of musical kind of terrain of it.
Stars?
It's a 3 for me.
A 3 from you. And John, like, I mean, I remember seeing the scenes from The World's a Little Blurry, the Netflix documentary about Billie Eilish, and the way they work together.
It's
extraordinary.
They've got a brilliant connection.
And it is the two of them. She's the front woman, obviously, but the two...
And it's great for her to have somebody of that caliber but she is a real star, and for me it's a 3-star album.
I probably
won't revisit it.
Okay, so Phineas and Optimist, the third album we're speaking about this evening, Joy Crooks' Skin and Coldplay's Music of the Spheres, the other two albums, Zara Hederman and John Marr with us this evening. Just before we go, actually, hats off and congratulations to Grafton Architects winning the Stirling Prize last night, the equivalent of, I suppose, really, like an Irish writer winning the Booker, isn't it? In their case, it was the Pritzker in 2020 was the previous prize they'd won, and the Reba Gold Medal. And it's for Yvonne Farrell and Shelley McNamara, and it's for the UK's best new building for Kingston University's free-flowing townhouse, a welcoming, transparent cathedral of social interaction, perfect for students to spark off each other. That's what we're told. And congratulations to them on the winning of that award. That is our lot for this Friday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Ola McGowan. Talk to you on Monday, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio.